You're very welcome if you're a Christian wanting to do a bit of thinking, or if you're somebody who isn't a Christian who's just looking in at what Christians are up to, you're also very, very welcome. These 3 evenings that we're going to do, I'm going to just talk to you very briefly about some kind of assumptions I'm making. We're trying to get a sense of what the Bible says about these things. So we are making an assumption that we've got a high view of Scripture, and we're trying to make sense of our culture and the culture that the Bible was written in and what the Bible says. So that's a major part of what we're doing this evening. It's going to be 60 minutes. We're determined to keep it to 60 minutes, even though I'm running slightly late already. And it's going to be fast and furious. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on. So we're going to try and cover a lot of ground. And that means sometimes it might not be quite as in-depth as you'd like. But I'm hoping it's going to be a starting point for us to think about these issues. And you can go away and maybe chat to your friends or other Christians or do some reading. And it'll just give you some food for thought. So you are very, very welcome. We're going to start with a film clip.
Mathematician that can look beyond the numbers. Math that doesn't yet exist.
Such an important story. And the idea that it was actually true.
Catherine is a gal for that. She can handle any numbers you put in front of her.
I never knew there were women working on engineering and aeronautics at NASA during the space race.
They were all these smart and brilliant-minded women who were hidden.
But they had really next-level jobs.
Colonel Glenn?
Shall we launch this rocket?
We're putting a human on top of a missile, shooting her into space, and it's never been done before.
Do you have the numbers that can get us up there before Russia?
These women changed the game.
It's wonderful to play a strong woman, but they have vulnerabilities.
You've been gone for 300 hours.
Was Mama gone for 12 and a half days?
No, but it felt like it.
It felt like it to me, too.
These ordinary women did extraordinary things.
It's crunch time. In 14 days, astronauts will be here for training. Everything we do can matter to their wives, to their children. I believe it's going to matter to the whole damn country.
Think about what that struggle must have felt like.
There's no protocol for women attending.
There's no protocol for a man circling the earth either, sir.
Hidden Figures is about how black and white, man and woman, put a man in space.
That's empowerment.
There's a real fireball outside. It's getting a little hot in here.
We're in the fight of our lives, people.
Chance to see Hidden Figures is absolutely brilliant. One of my favorite films of this year, and it's not just because it's all about maths. Very, very interesting. And although the events took place 50 years ago, it's fascinating how those issues, obviously race issues, but also gender issues, capture the imagination of audiences. And that's what we're going to be looking at today. We're going to be looking at what are the differences between men and women? What are the similarities? How does that play out in our culture? What does the church think about those things? What does the Bible say about those things? And so this week, Kat and Leanne have been out with a camera doing a bit of roving questionnaires. And so we've got the first of our 3 Vox Pop clips, which we're going to show you, which is all about what are the differences between men and women, apart from the obvious ones. Okay, folks, time for you to do some work. On your tables, you should find a little batch of paperclip arenas, areas where men and women might approach things a little bit differently. What I'd like you to do is spread them out on your table and see if you can rank them according to, at the top, the ones where we are most different between the genders, and at the bottom, the ones where, well, not much difference at all. If you are a little group and you don't have access to those, just put your hand in the air and I'll give you one, but there should be little clusters of strips all around the room. Did you find that even in that context, the genders were starting to show themselves a little bit? Okay. No. Annie was mentioning Venus and Mars earlier, and that obviously was a phenomenally successful book. And I guess after the kind of 70s wave of feminism, a lot of people quite enjoyed the fact that here was somebody who was talking about the differences in a way which wasn't a value judgment. Talking about the way that guys did things for a certain reason and the way that girls did things from a certain perspective as well. A hugely successful book. And I'm not really sure there's a huge amount of science behind that book, but I think a lot of us enjoyed the fact that it celebrated the diversity that is in genders. But interestingly enough, Elaine Stalky, I really recommend this as a book to have a think about. It's only just about 100 pages long. But Elaine Stalky, she's got like a brain twice as big as mine, possibly three times as big. Phenomenal woman, and she's written a number of things on gender. And she talks about how recent research suggests that in these areas, this is where often there are differences between gender. Lots of large-scale studies. And so the suggestion is that, yes, probably, certainly within our culture, men and women do operate slightly differently. It's stereotypical, but stereotypes often have a root in reality, don't they? That's why they take hold. So let's have a look at our next Vox Pop clip. A quick whistle-stop tour of the Bible on gender. So it's going to be incredibly quick. The first thing I want to do is have a look at the Old Testament. And I want to answer some questions that often arise, particularly from feminists, that it's probably worth just kind of dealing with those straight away. The first one is God male? And at that point, we have a kind of deficiency of our language, don't we? Because we don't have a neuter pronoun we can use. It's clear that God is spirit in the Bible, so the whole gender thing doesn't really work at all. Anne Brown, in her excellent Apology to Women book, describes it this way. She says, God, as spirit, is neither male nor female, but is beyond gender or genderless. In fact, to ask God whether God is physically male or female is a nonsense question. It's like asking whether the wind is red or blue. So, first question. Next one. If man was created first, doesn't that make him superior? Well, perhaps he was Mark 1, and the women are Mark 2. I think the order thing doesn't really work as such, but perhaps we'll let Genesis speak to that one. I want you to listen to the number of times that I say the word them. This is from Genesis 1, 26 to 28. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the ground. And you can't really get away from those verses, can you? That there's that sense in which humanity is male and female. So there isn't any sense of the order making one superior. Third one. Wasn't Eve the weak link as the one who was tempted first? There's no evidence whatsoever about why Satan tempted Eve. The Bible is entirely silent on that subject. Don't get me wrong, much has been made by writers and church leaders over the years of what happened in Genesis, but there's actually no evidence to suggest that somehow Eve was the weak link in that situation. If you look at the way the passage plays out and the story plays out, both parties are culpable. Both are responsible. Both are taken to task by God. So there isn't any sense in which one party was more culpable than the other. Last one. Where are all the women in the Old Testament? Well, that's a good question, isn't it? And part of that is it was very, very clear it was a patriarchal society, a male-dominated society for thousands of years. Mainly, I guess, because the dominant gender was the strongest gender. Strength played a huge part in who was in charge. And yet, it's interesting, if you go through the Bible, if I mention some names, those of you who know your Bibles will think, oh yeah, what about them? Abigail, Deborah, Esther, Hannah, Huldah, Miriam, Naomi, Rachel, Rahab, Rebecca, Ruth, Sarah. All women who had a real impact in the Old Testament. They are in the minority, but that's much to do with the culture of the time, I think, rather than any particular bias on the part of the Bible. And then Jesus came. And we're going to have a reading now from Kat. Just looks at the whole way in which Jesus turned the whole thing upside down in terms of the way we view men and women.
In the culture of the time, the place of women was heavily prescribed and women were subordinate to men. Yet, Jesus never made any pronouncements about a woman's place, nor did he illustrate his teaching exclusively from male experience. The culture of the time taught that it is better that the words of the law should be burned than that they should be given to a woman. Yet Jesus took time out to teach women as well as men. The culture of the time meant that women were probably separated from men for most of their lives. Yet women left their homes, took to the road and followed Jesus. Some of them, such as Mary, Joanna and Susanna, supported Jesus financially. In the culture of the time, religious leaders, disciples, would have been male, yet Jesus's were male and female. In the culture of the time, a woman could not act as a witness in court of law because it was assumed that her evidence was unreliable. Yet women were chosen as the first witnesses to the resurrection and were told to tell others, other followers of Jesus. In the culture of the time, women were secluded and covered to prevent men from lusting after them. Yet Jesus did not accept the inevitability of lust and challenged those objectifying women to take responsibility for their desires. The culture of the time stoned women caught in adultery. Yet Jesus had no time for this double standard, and when asked to participate in the condemnation of such a woman, exposed the hypocrisy and double standards of the men eager for her punishment. In the culture of the time, women, slaves and Gentiles were all denied full membership into the religious community. Yet, in Christ, believers share the same spiritual status, regardless of gender, race and class.
Thanks very much, Kat. So Jesus completely changed the way that the religious leaders of the time looked at women. And that carried on into the New Testament church. And in the New Testament, we see women taking a much greater role in the expansion of the gospel. And I want to just show you a passage which I think is really, really interesting in terms of not what Paul's theology was in terms of women, but what happened, that's dense, isn't it? What happened in terms of his practice. Now, if you've got a Bible in front of you, you might want to turn to it yourself. It's Romans 16. And this is the salutations. And to be honest, it's probably a bit that most of us skip over fairly quickly, because all the kind of meaty theology in Romans has happened by this stage. And Paul's kind of signing off and just saying hello to all his friends. And so it would be easy to skip across this. And what I want to point out is the women in this section and the way that he addresses them. Who were these women? Well, altogether, out of this list, there were 10 women out of 27. And if you look closely, you can see that Paul also gives some clues as to the significant role that they played at the time. He suggests that Phoebe be received as Paul's emissary to remain with the church. Priscilla, a female leader, earned respect as a house church leader, a teacher of men, a courageous leader who risked her neck for the gospel. She is also a woman Paul celebrates as his co-worker. He talks about Mary and the leadership of Junia the Apostle. Not only was Junia an apostle, but she was prominent amongst the apostles. Now, we don't entirely know what that means, but it's clear that when Paul is just relaxed and talking about the fellow workers, he reels off a whole list of women who are clearly standing shoulder to shoulder with the men at the time in important positions of leadership. Altogether, 10 out of 27. Don't know what your maths is like, but it's about 37%. Just want to show you another slide. I don't know how statistically significant that number is, but 37% compares favourably with the organisations in the UK in 2017. At the moment, if you have a look at UK companies, 23% are women leaders. That figure falls substantially if you look at a FTSE 100 company. So at the time of the New Testament church, there was clearly a significant number of women who were operating, doing all sorts of stuff, getting imprisoned, taking leadership positions, that Paul is acknowledging. And it seems that they continued what Jesus had started by being an organization, a community that involved both genders. We're going to have a look at another Vox Pop clip now. Okay, so we're thinking about where we go next with this, and we decided that we'd do a little bit of an interview. So Leanne's going to come and join me now. Are you okay, Leanne? Okay, is that whole kind of complementarity thing working? Is Tim going to effortlessly step in? Yes. Love it. Okay. I think I've got to point this thing at you now. Apparently it's very directional. Alrighty. So we thought we'd have a conversation about gender roles in the home. I was telling Naomi about this, and she was horrified that I was going to ask Leanne about her marriage and the house and all that kind of stuff. But we've had a conversation. You're okay about this, aren't you?
Yeah.
So, for those people who don't know you, if you had to describe yourself in 4 or 5 words, how would you describe yourself?
Chatty, smiley, mother, and friendly.
Very good. Okay. Yeah. And in terms of the jobs that you do or the roles that you do in your household, how do you work out who does what?
And I think we've done this on purpose. But looking at it, I think we are quite traditional in the sense where I am staying at home with the kids. Tim is the one who's bringing in the money. That hasn't been something that we've done on purpose. I wanted to be with the kids. I think Tim joked when it came to paternity, he might take a few months off. That's just because he wanted some time off. And I was like, no way. So yeah, I guess that's how we figure out in our family. It works well with us.
And when we talked, I got the sense that you definitely subordinated your what you were doing to what Tim was doing. Is that fair?
Yeah, that was kind of an eye-opener. And again, it hadn't something we'd done on purpose. So when Tim graduated university, he was looking for a job. I was working in antisocial behaviour at the time, and it wasn't questioned that we would stay in Manchester. It'd be wherever Tim had found a job, I would go, and then I would find another job.
Yes.
So, yeah, I guess so. It has always been, yeah, I guess, because he'd finished the university. I just followed him.
When you started this conversation just now, you were kind of, it almost felt like you were being apologetic for having a traditional role. Does that mean that you don't think that you're necessarily typical or that it has to be that way?
No, definitely not. I have good friends who the husband stays at home and the wife was the breadwinner because she was maybe a doctor so she could earn more and could bring more into the family.
Yeah, so this is something that you've decided
and
it works for you and Tim.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, what about decisions? So you've got to make some decisions. How does that work?
So we're definitely a partnership when it comes to kind of running the house or making the big decisions. So we would always discuss before, big decisions were to be made. And my personality, so I'm quite headstrong kind of person. I think my opinion is right, be it right or wrong, but it isn't right most of the time. So I have to check myself that I'm not the one who's always, forcing my opinion as such, because, we are a team in decision making.
Yes.
But I guess if it came to, the crunch, and if there was a moment where we both were just, we couldn't decide on a decision for whatever reason, I think I probably would then let Tim, as head of my marriage, I would probably go with what he said. And for good reason. I wouldn't just do it because I'm the wife. I definitely don't think I'm a lower race by any stretch of the imagination. But I know he respects me 100%. Like when we went into this marriage, I made the vow to obey my husband.
Yes.
But it's because
we talked about that.
Yeah, because 100%. I know He wouldn't ever do anything to hurt me. And he has proved that, you know, numerous times. It wouldn't be something he would subconsciously do to hurt me. So for me to give my opinion to him and to try and sway him for whatever reason, if he was still, well, actually, I think this is right for our family, then I would then probably, you know, say, well, that's fine. We'll see where we go with that.
Yeah.
So.
Can I ask, has that ever happened? You don't need to do specifics, but so far you've not arrived at a point where there's a decision that needs to be made. Status quo won't work. A or B has to be chosen, and you disagree. That hasn't sort of come up as yet.
You know, it probably has. I think it probably has. I can't think of anything major. The other night, I was having a nightmare putting Micah down for whatever reason. I was trying to, I don't know, catch up on some TV, and he was just crying every 20 minutes, and it was doing my head in. So Tim went up so I could carry on doing what I was doing. And he came down, and he was like, well, maybe we should just bring him down. He can just chill out with us down here. And I was like, no, that's not going to work. He has to stay in his bed. Tim's like, yes, but you're not enjoying your evening. And I was like, and at first I was just like, that's just, you know, that's rubbish. Why would we do that? But then I was like, well, maybe he has got a point, and maybe we could try it.
Yes.
So we didn't have to. He did actually settle after that. But I can't think of anything where it's been major, and I've had to go, okay,
yeah,
we'll let you decide.
Can I ask you about a term you used earlier, head of the household? Did you use that?
I probably did.
Can you just unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, and again, it's not because I am some weaker race. Or, you know, I feel like I need to be subordinate to my husband. But I would say that I want, you know, him to be head of my house. And I'm not apologetic to that. I feel I'm happy. And again, I think it's because of the respect I know he has for me. You know, during our wedding, the guy who married us preached on how the husband has a tougher job because he has to love his wife like he loves himself. So I know that is the stake. You know, I know Tim strives for that. And I hope I'm not painting him as this perfect husband. Because you're sounding pretty good from up here. But, and he's all right. But, yeah, I think, like, I like the fact that we're definitely a partnership, but I'm happy that he is, that he would, if need be, have the end decision making.
That's pre-decided.
I think, I think so, in my head, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Leanne, thank you very much. Okay, I wanted to do something as well on, because I think a lot of these discussions inevitably focus on kind of feminism and equality. But one of the aspects of the whole debate on gender is looking at masculinity. And I wanted to just spend a few moments looking at that, because I thought that might be an interesting kind of take on the evening as well. What does it mean to be a fella, a guy in 2017? And so I'm going to show you a couple of slides, which I think are quite interesting. The first slide is a passage that if you've been in church for a while, you'll be very familiar with. And it's Paul talking about what the fruits of the Spirit look like. And you read that and you're all going to say, yeah, I mean, it's great. And we've all grown up with that if we've been involved in church. But it kind of looks a little bit gentle, possibly a bit feminine. I want to just kind of give you a way of looking at this passage, which brings in a little bit of context. Because when you read this, you need to understand what the early church would have heard, because they would have known it had come from Paul. And that would have meant an enormous amount. Okay, let me show you the next slide. Okay, any ideas who that is? Right, the gentleman on the screen is a gentleman called Chuck Norris. Okay, Chuck Norris is an action actor, and he was actually part of, I think, Enter the Dragon, the Bruce Lee film, years ago, martial arts guy. And he was doing moderately successful as an actor, And then around about the kind of 2005, an American comedian started to run with Chuck Norris facts. And some of you might have come across these. These are facts about Chuck Norris. It's kind of apocryphal. Let me give you a few. Chuck Norris has a diary. It's called the Guinness Book of World Records. Chuck Norris can kill two stones with one bird. Once a cobra bit Chuck Norris's leg. After five days of excruciating pain, the cobra died. Giraffes were created when Chuck Norris uppercutted a horse. When Chuck Norris was in school, his English teacher assigned an essay called What is Courage? He received an A+ for turning in a blank page with only his name at the top. And if you Google Chuck Norris facts, you'll find hundreds of these extreme exaggerations of masculinity. Well, one of the things that you need to be aware of is when the early church saw that passage from Galatians, the context they would have known about would have been just how tough Paul was. If we just put the next passage up, he was very much the Chuck Norris of the New Testament, except he did it for real. It wasn't some comedy act. If you read this passage in 2 Corinthians, 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. They did minus one. I don't know whether you know that. They basically worked out that most people would probably be permanently disabled at 40. And also, if you're whipping something, it's difficult to keep count. So if you do 40 minus one, there's more chance you won't actually exceed 40. 5 times that happened. 3 times he was beaten with rods. Once he was pelted with stones. We know that because, actually, the stoning stopped when the stoners thought the stonee was dead. And they left, and then he got up and went to the next city. That's how tough this guy was. 3 times he was shipwrecked. Spent a day and a night in the open sea. Constantly on the move. Danger from rivers. I once did a course on mountaineering, and there were 3 rules for river crossing. Don't ever do it. Don't ever do it. Don't ever do it. Really, really dangerous. Bandits, fellow Jews, Gentiles. So when Paul writes this passage about gentleness, the background would have been this was a man who was incredibly tough. He had all the qualities of courage, determination, persistence. Sometimes it was almost reckless, the things that he did. And yet he still managed to talk about gentleness, patience, self-control. And so when we as fellas, and I'm sure a lot of these operate just as strongly for women as well, when we look at that passage, we need to know that the context was the man who was suggesting those things was an extraordinarily tough guy with incredible endurance. So where does that leave us? I want to do some questions and answers at the end. I want to put a summary slide up because I think one of the things that's interesting about the New Testament is that gender, it's a little bit complicated. When you look at something like, you know, is it cultural or is it biological? Well, the Bible seems to suggest that men and women are different, but also that there's a huge amount of similarity, that there's a huge amount of complementarity, and that together, when you put men and women together in a community or in a marriage, together they reflect the image of God. And so I want to spend a few minutes doing questions and answers and maybe trying to just bounce some things around. Can I suggest that you take a couple of minutes just to think about any questions you might have? I'm conscious that some of you might be wanting to reflect on that. And then we'll just chuck things around. And I promise faithfully we would finish inside of 60 minutes. So take 2 minutes, talk to your next door neighbours, ask any questions you want on the post-it notes, or if you want to just call them out in a couple of minutes, we'll see what we can do. Off you go.
Because of the economic situation.
Yes.
But if the economic situation wasn't there, how many women would want to go out in the world? How many women would like to stay at home
and look after the children.
Yeah.
And it's such a bad thing over the generation.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose my perspective on that would be that I want women to have a choice. But I agree with you that the current situation, a lot of women and men don't have a choice because they need to go out and pay the bills.
They can't get a mortgage now unless they've got a mortgage.
No.
When we first got our mortgage, we raised solar and wind income.
Yeah.
The woman income didn't take this. Mm. Even if she earned more, it was an irrelevant.
Yeah.
But now the couple both have to work to make it go. Not through choice women work. A lot of them don't have that choice. It's a fact that they have to maintain where they are.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. Jared.
I think there's a whole interesting bit in your sweep through the Bible, which I recognise was brief, but there are the difficult passages in 1 Corinthians and in Paul's letter to Timothy,
yes,
where which are oft quoted, sometimes in seriousness, sometimes in jest,
yeah,
about women should keep silent in church. I don't permit a woman to have authority over a man. Those sort of things. I wonder whether you had any thoughts about those. I see them as entirely.
You always tackle all of them.
I see both those things entirely rooted in their culture and
yes.
not absolutes.
Yeah.
And I think more time as a whole talk about why they're not absolutes. But
I can do. Thankfully, I was talking to my daughter this afternoon, and a lot of stuff fell into place. We were chatting about the Corinthians passage, if you know it. That one is the one that talks about women being silent, doesn't it? And I think that if you read the beginning of that chapter, it gives a whole list of instructions to brothers and sisters about the orderly conduct in the church. And the implication, I think, or probably even stronger than implication, is that Paul must have been talking to men and women who were going to be making contributions in some way. And for me, that suggests that perhaps we don't fully understand the context of what it was he was trying to stop. And there's the possibility that I've read that men and women were segregated, as they would have been in the synagogues, and the women were calling out for clarification, and it was just getting a little bit chaotic. And so that the passage isn't necessarily talking, isn't a generalised women you've got to be quiet in church completely and don't have a contribution to make. I think that the 1 Timothy 2 passage, which again is one that is often talked about, I have the faintest idea what that passage is about. In the sense that it talks about authority, and then the chapter finishes off with women being saved by childbirth. And I've read lots and lots of commentaries about that, and I am still not really convinced by any of them. I think it seems to be a passage which I just find genuinely difficult, and one day it might be very, very clear to me. I think I'm reluctant, this is my own view, and part of the purpose of what we're doing today is recognising that as a church we're going to learn how to debate these things. So some of you might not agree with this. And hopefully we can continue to debate and you can enlighten me and I can enlighten you. But it seems to me unwise to establish a very important principle on a passage that we don't really understand. And if there were two or three passages that had very theological underpinning that said, basically, there's no place for women in authority, then that would be crystal clear. But it doesn't seem to me, particularly because I deliberately put the Romans passage on, it doesn't seem to me that that's what Paul was doing in terms of practice in the early church. And so I am not sure about the 1 Timothy 2. So personally speaking, I'm in a church where my minister's boss is a woman, and I'm entirely happy with that. But that might be something you want to...
So is the minister.
Just for the record. Were there any other passages you wanted me to... engagement. Any other thoughts, folks? Yes?
I was thinking about that there are, you know, small minority groups that are born into the sex, so they're not particularly a male or female.
Yes.
I don't know how that fits into the whole debate, but whether, you know, presumably that's where the culture changes, it's just like a grey area, isn't it? Maybe it's a grey
No, it is, and I'm facing this in a slightly different form in the context of my school, where the whole transgender debate is very, very live. I've taught now two students who are going through sex changes, and I've had to change their names in the register, and the most difficult thing is actually the pronouns in my head. I've got one gender pronoun locked into my memory banks, and so that's a very live issue. I don't know what I think about that yet, but I certainly know that the church will have to engage with the transgender and also the gay issue, but I'm not going to do that today. But it's, yeah, you're quite right. Folks, I hope that's been helpful, and feel free to continue conversations. Can I say a couple of things? Firstly, this is the first time we've done something in this sort of format, and Leanne and Kat and myself have been trying out all sorts of different things. Please feedback what you think about the duration, about the content, about the style. We're keen to do something that's punchy and that's something that's interesting and varied. So give us any feedback you like, talk to us verbally, email us, that'll be great. On the 11th of June, I think it is, Gareth, isn't it? We're going to do something on money, and it's going to be money to do with the individual, but it's also going to be looking at capitalism. So an opportunity to think about that. And then we're going to look at suffering, which is the one after in July. So do feel free to come to those as well. Thank you very much.